You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 144, The Mines of Potosí, Part 4. Over the years, I've developed quite a fascination with mining and the rushes which a company finds precious metals, gemstones, or even valuable non-mineral resources, like the rubber boom in the Amazon, for example. There is something really interesting about the social impacts these events have. Often they take place in remote and inhospitable places, and the stories they throw up are often ones of adventure, fortunes made and lost, lawlessness and danger. The busts which follow are equally interesting, often leaving strange white elephants marooned in bizarre places. I've had the chance to come into contact with a few boom towns in my life. The first was Potosí itself, when I visited for a few days. I wrote my master's thesis a few years later on a proposed gold mine in the mountains of Nicaragua. The village was remote and a bit rowdy, if I'm honest, about a third of the way along the single dirt road, which just about connected the northern half of the Caribbean coast to the rest of the country. Mining was new in the area I was looking at, but further along that road, deep into the rainforested middle of nowhere, the map revealed tiny little settlements with names like Bonanza, Pioneer, and Columbus Mine. Names which stood out from the Spanish and indigenous ones which surrounded them. There was never a gold rush here, but I found some accounts written by mining engineers from Canada in the early and mid-20th century, who helped set up an extractive industry here. It sounds like it was pretty adventurous. I was in Nicaragua to study the conflicts between another Canadian mining company and the local community who opposed the proposed mine. A quick search on the internet reveals that the power of gold and mining still creates conflict in that part of Nicaragua, and some of the news articles read like old Wild West stories. There are accusations of massacres in indigenous villages, for example. Later, when I worked as an anthropologist in Australia, mining was all around me. It drives the economy of the state of Western Australia, and a large part of the job revolved around the interplay between mining companies and Aboriginal peoples. I moved to Kalgoorlie, a fascinating place lost deep in the outback, surrounded by desert and still largely driven by mining. This really was the Wild West. For a few decades, around the turn of the 20th century, a gold rush started here when three Irishmen came across a seam of the metal by chance. Within weeks, thousands of people were walking for days across the desert to try and make their fortune. Today it's hard to walk in the bush without coming across old mine shafts. Many died of thirst or accidents, attacks from Aboriginal people, or even lightning strikes. It was quite common to stumble upon abandoned ghost towns. You might find a cemetery lost in the scrub, its gravestones the only evidence of a community which thrived for a short while before the gold ran out. Kalgoorlie itself possesses some of the finest historic buildings in Australia, and as evidence of the rowdy nature of the town, the pubs are often the most spectacular buildings. They really are beautiful. The architecture is elaborate and incredible. But they feel so strange and out of place. In its heyday, Kalgoorlie thrived, and even managed to draw in future US President Herbert Hoover to oversee a mine a few hours' drive away. Today, it and the other goldfield towns have dwindled, and its population is much more sensible for such a remote desert settlement. Half the town has been destroyed by the vast super pit at the end of the main high street, one of the biggest open pit mines in the world. And some people still make their living, going out into the bush for days at a time with metal detectors and selling the gold they manage to prospect. It feels like a rough and ready place, a real frontier mining town. So I've seen, studied, and lived in a few ex-boom towns, but never one during its glory days. Modern society and economics doesn't really allow for that to happen in the same way. All of these places are linked by their connection to mining. There is something similar between all of them, despite their geographical and cultural diversity. They share a feeling, an atmosphere, which I think cuts across time and place. Although the indigenous cultures are very different between the Western Australian goldfields and Potosi, they do share a strong living indigenous heritage. And although Potosi had declined in the decades just before Kalgoorlie was established, and the Spanish Empire and culture differs from the British one, the colonial context also creates similarities between the two places. The low-lying desert of Australia is not quite like the Altiplano of Bolivia, but actually they are quite similar in their remoteness, their lack of vegetation, and their environmental inhospitableness. Despite the difference in time, the economics of both places are very similar, and as precious metal was the only real reason for their existence, their characters were shaped in very similar ways. I'm sure the people who have learnt about or visited the towns where the California gold rush happened will probably recognise what I'm talking about. As usual, this introduction has ended up being much longer than I intended. I wanted to start with these comparisons between mining towns and rushes, because the town of Potosi itself is the subject of today's episode, and hopefully this introduction helps to contextualise the feeling that the town might have possessed during its golden age, which it still does possess today to a large extent. So far we've looked at the experience of visiting Potosi today, at what the mines themselves were like, and at the macro level global impact which they had. Today I want to humanise it all, to try to imagine what it might have been like to be a person there, playing their small part in the rich story of this extraordinary city. Galeano, that Uruguayan author I mentioned last episode, provides a couple of good statistics to contextualize life in colonial Potosi. He says that America's Fountain of Silver had 120,000 inhabitants by the census of 1573. Only 28 years had passed since the city sprouted out of the Andean wilderness, and already, as if by magic, it had the same population as London, and more than Seville, Madrid, Rome, or Paris. Elsewhere, he says that, in 1579, the royal judge, Matienzo, complained, "There is never a shortage of novelty, scandal, and wantonness." Potosi had, at the time, 800 professional gamblers and 120 famous prostitutes, whose resplendent salons were thronged with wealthy miners. In 1608, Potosi celebrated the Feast of the Holy Sacrament with 6 days of plays and 6 days of masked balls, 8 days of bullfights and 3 of fiestas, 2 of tournaments and other dissipations. So this really was a boomtown, and it's worth remembering that all this grandeur and wealth existed in the desolate, empty and cold Altiplano, in one of the highest cities on earth. Like the photos I've seen of Kalgoorlie, in Potosi's earliest days, its population, having rushed there, lived not in buildings but in tents. This soon changed as the silver began to emerge from the hill, and those who profited from it used the money to build themselves elaborate mansions. Hernando Pizarro, one of the famous conquistador's brothers, was among the first, owning a building there in 1549. The upgrading would have been rapid, but it would have taken place in stages. From those tents, the first buildings were simple constructions of bricks made from compressed earth. None of the material needed for better buildings existed here on the roof of the world. It took time and money for wood and stone to be brought up from the lowlands. Of course, one thing that wasn't lacking was silver. The improvised churches of the early days may not have initially been impressive constructions, but they were decorated with intricate and grand silver artwork. Like in Kalgoorlie, the city was divided in two. The colonists occupied the centre. The indigenous population lived on the other side of a small river towards the Cerro Rico. That indigenous section was itself split into 14 parishes. Each one had a particular indigenous ethnic group connected to it. Whether or not this segregation grew up organically, in 1565, so pretty early on, a law was passed which legalized it, for the protection of the indigenous peoples, it itself said. It said that no non-indigenous person of any kind was to trade within the indigenous parishes or to sell food there, and that no black person was to enter them. The segregation wasn't total, however. Unusually for colonial Peru, a large indigenous market sat just off the main square. In 1603, a man whose name and identity are lost visited Potosí and wrote a detailed and very useful account of it. I will refer to it from here on as the 1603 account because, well, that's the obvious thing to do. He says that when he visited, at least 60,000 people lived in the indigenous section and 6,000 in the Spanish colonial centre. Many of these would have been non-Spanish Europeans. He also said that there were 5,000 Africans living in that centre. Now obviously, add those numbers up and you fall far short of the 120,000 I mentioned were said to live there 30 years earlier. After giving these estimates, the author himself says that estimating the population is impossible, and that there could have been as many as 120,000 in the indigenous parishes alone. So he's not that helpful then when it comes to guessing overall numbers. But I do think his account is useful because it gives an idea of the rough proportions between the different groups. The vast majority of people in Potosí were indigenous, it seems. As you might expect, from a rough and ready mining town in inhospitable surroundings, the population skewed heavily male. The writer guesses that of the European population, 2/3 were men. This gender disparity was found among the religious members of the population too, of which there were many. Until 1650, there were no nunneries in Potosí, but plenty of monks, and all the major Catholic orders had bases there. The writer gives a detailed census of the professionals in the city, which included lawyers and various types of doctors, as well as of the shops. Interestingly, hat and shoemakers were overly represented. Presumably the cold and the hard work wearing out the shoes had something to do with this. According to Chris Lane's book, on top of this, large batches of shoes were also regularly sent from Quito, so Potosí's population must have been getting through them. Every good available to the rich Spaniard, at home or in the empire, was soon to be found in Potosí, shipped up the sides of the Andes, probably at great expense, so that those making their fortunes could enjoy some of the comforts found in less remote cities. There were rubies from Myanmar and emeralds from Colombia, spices from Indonesia and rice from Italy, porcelain plates from China and glass from Venice, ivory from Africa, and pearls from the Caribbean. Of course, what would have seemed to be exotic local goods desired by the indigenous population would also have been in good supply. Alongside this, there were the people, drawn from three continents. This boomtown drew in all sorts of characters. Other accounts of Potosí describe it itself as a fascinating attraction. A bizarre metropolis in a strange place, but a boom metropolis all the same. There were one.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Wild parties, and these merged with the many religious processions led by the Catholic orders, but co-opted by indigenous traditions and the rowdy ways of the miners. All of this was fueled by fortunes of silver and the desire to escape the hardship of the work and the poverty of those who had not yet made their finds. A feature of Potosí architecture which developed was the high frequency of wooden balconies, created so that the upper-class women would have somewhere to watch the processions without having to be in among them. Their husbands found an outlet for social competition and showing off by trying to outdo each other in funding the Christian celebrations, which the processions were at least nominally related to. Each wanted to make theirs more ostentatious than their neighbours, to demonstrate how much silver wealth they possessed. Sometimes the festivals went on for days. When Philip IV was crowned, the council spent so much money on a party that it temporarily bankrupted itself. They need not have worried too much, however. It wouldn't take long to refill the coffers with silver. The lower classes put on raucous comedy plays in the streets. Gambling dens were everywhere, and their patrons often resorted to dueling each other. That 1603 account says that when its altar visited, there were 700 or 800 men, more rather than less, who are idle and whose occupation is ambling and gambling. And there are 120 women, respectably dressed, in shawls and petticoats, who are openly known to occupy themselves in the amorous profession. So let's look then at some of the most notable individuals who spent time in Potosí and who contributed to this cosmopolitan and licentious atmosphere. Elias Almusili is interesting mainly because of where he was from. He demonstrates how the lure of silver brought people in from all over the world. He was an Assyrian Christian from Baghdad, who decided to become a Marco Polo-style figure, exploring and writing about distant lands. Potosí was the centerpiece of his South American travels, having gained permission from the Austrian mother of the Spanish king to collect silver there, which could be used to support the tiny Catholic church in his home country, of which he was a member. He writes about Potosí with fascination, and given that Baghdad was a large cosmopolitan city, this says something. He does, however, talk about how worried he was about getting his silver safely home, and how he only narrowly dodged a pirate attack on Veracruz in Mexico as he did so. Then there was the man named Juan Perez, but popularly known as El Duende. He became famous in the 1650s. A duende is a type of spirit in Spanish tradition that is sometimes translated into English as hobgoblin. In the Potosí region, it seems to have fused with indigenous traditions to take on a specific form as an evil and dangerous supernatural species sent by Satan, who would occupy a house and cause harm to its residents. Perez had been brought to Potosí from Africa as a slave, and according to some accounts, seems to have decided to react to his new situation by turning to a life of violent crime, hence the nickname, before being caught and executed. According to this story, for a time he haunted the city, and he seems to have been painted a bit like Jack the Ripper was in London. This may not have been the actual truth of things, according to Chris Lane, however, who suggests that he was simply involved in a street fight, of which he was judged to have been the guilty party by the authorities. Another colourful figure was Catalina de Arauso. Her life is an incredible story, and I will definitely give her an episode of her own at some point. She was from Spain, and after some time living as a nun, she escaped the convent and disguised herself as a man, calling herself Antonio, and setting off adventuring, first in Spain and then in Latin America. She got up to some incredible antics, which I plan to look at in detail in that episode, so I won't go through here. But for a few years, in the early 1600s, she lived in Potosí as a llama herder and soldier. During this time, she is said to have saved a woman from her revenge-driven husband after the woman is said to have had an affair, and to have killed a man in a duel brought on while playing cards. A few decades later, Anna and Doña Eustaquia, two girls, one the daughter of a rich local and the other an orphan who grew up in the same house, also took to dressing as men and causing trouble. First, they are said to have killed a corrupt soldier who approached them one night, looking for trouble. Then, they got into another confrontation while playing guitar and singing outside a rich man's house. The man is supposed to have thought that they were trying to seduce his daughter. The argument resulted in one of them firing a pistol at another group of men who had got involved, and sparking a mass brawl slash sword fight. One man's sword went through Anna's shield and into her chest, but she managed to recover enough to cut his hand in retaliation before the girls managed to retreat. They were then locked inside their house to prevent them from causing more trouble, but escaped and left Potosí to become involved in more adventures across the viceroyalty for the next several years. All of this was done by the age of 20, when they returned to take up the Doña's inheritance. Apparently they had been bullfighting in Lima, and a wound suffered while doing this killed Anna not long afterwards. The story goes that the Doña then died herself of grief. These people are the most exciting that I could find, but Potosí also produced men like Bartolomé Arzans, a very well-respected writer who wrote A History of Potosí in 1705, which came to 1 million words, as well as Melchor Pérez Holguín, among the most famous painters in the whole of colonial Latin America. There was Vicente Bernedo, who was so religious that he lived as a hermit, first in the bell tower of one of the city's churches, and then in a hut. He denied himself any comfort or protection from the freezing cold, and his piety was an example known throughout the Spanish Empire. Several disasters befell Potosí over the centuries, all of which add to its rich story. The first was a series of epidemics which periodically hit the city. A disease of some kind was sweeping the Andes at the very moment Potosí's silver was being discovered. It was followed by two more that century, the last being smallpox, and four more between 1600 and 1650. These ones included measles, diphtheria, and even the Black Plague. Epidemics caused huge rates of death amongst the indigenous people across the Americas, and although it was worse in the tropical lowlands, it certainly caused a large drop in the population in Potosí as well. The highlands lost many people, and when a census was done in 1689, it was discovered that many of the survivors had lost their connection to their villages and communities, partly because some of these had almost died out, but partly because some had decided that it was better to migrate and work as wage labourers for large landowners in today's northern Argentina than to stick around and be called up for meter service. Then there was the flood in 1626. This happened when a dam, which had been constructed to provide water to feed the smelting industry, gave way and the water it held back rushed into the town. It followed the path of that river, which separated the Spanish and indigenous sections of the city, so both populations were affected. Hundreds of people died. Unfortunately, we can't be any more precise than that. And lots of people lost their smelting businesses as their equipment was swept away. Perhaps the most interesting disaster to affect the lives of the people of Potosí was the dramatic sounding War of the Basques and Vicuñas. The Basque people were overly represented in Potosí's population. They are, if you don't know, an ancient culture which predates all the other types of Spaniard, and who live in the border region between France and Spain, and speak a language completely unrelated to any other. That said, by this point, they were an important part of the composite nation that Spain was, and Basques had been involved in the project of empire from the beginning, contributing several prominent conquistadors. The vicuña is an Andean animal, closely related to the llama. In colonial Potosí, it came to refer to Spaniards from Extremadura, that southern region which produced many more famous conquistadors, including Pizarro and Cortés, as well as to Andalusians. Apparently, some of them liked to wear hats made out of vicuña skin. Now, the Basques did very well out of the mines. They appear to have stuck together to support new arrivals and managed to consolidate wealth and political power. This caused resentment amongst the southern Spaniards. Tensions started to turn into violent confrontations in 1615, but it wasn't until 1622 that a Basque, who I've seen described as a hitman, was murdered, and the war properly began. I guess the best comparison would be modern-day gang warfare, although I guess it was also a sort of race-based conflict as well, and some historians have even argued that it was more like a class war between the disenfranchised vicuñas and the ruling Basque elite. It is a bit of all these things, but some of it does sound a lot like a prohibition mafia story. A new crown inspector helped tip things over the edge when he exposed a network of corruption. Basque smelters were bribing Basque politicians so that they could avoid paying taxes on mercury. The inspector, presumably from the same region as the vicuñas, seems to have used this as a way to break Basque power in Potosí, removing several city councillors and appointing Extremadurans in their place. Now political power was split, and confrontation was inevitable. That Basque hitman's death caused a retaliatory hit, and this spiraled into vendettas and ambushes. The Basques may have initially held the power, but in terms of numbers, they were in the minority, and so they lost more men in the war. By the end, the vicuñas were accused of killing 64 people. The vicuña leader became a friar and tried to broker a peace deal. The crown sent a special force to hunt the vicuña outlaws down, who were hiding in the mountains. 40 of them were executed. The whole thing lasted about 3 years before the king issued an amnesty. One of the two men he sent to start rebuilding the local government and to maintain the newfound peace seems to have favoured the Basques, however, and so they retained a good amount of power once he had finished his work. That was the end of the war. The authorities would not tolerate further outbreaks of violence, but the bad blood between the two groups lingered for decades, and fear of reigniting the conflict did influence viceregal policy. There was one more disaster which hit Potosí, and this one had ramifications for the rest of the world as well. The Great Potosí Mint Fraud of 1649. This incredible story, part investigative thriller, part mobland crime drama, is the subject of next week's episode. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to do something to help the podcast out, one thing which is quick and easy to do is leaving a review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps new people discover the show. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.